From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's edition of Fresh Air, I speak with comic Jackie Mason. His one-man show lampoons the differences between Jewish and Gentile humor, but this rabbi-turned-comedian says the Jews' love of comedy has its roots in shared misery. Also today, I speak with Robert Hunter. He writes lyrics that the Grateful Dead's Jerry Garcia turns into rock anthems, like Uncle John's Band and Truckin'. Lyricist Hunter has a new album of his own in which he sings his own songs. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new home video release of Repercussions, a documentary on African and Afro-American music. And television critic David Bianculli talks about how the VCR has changed the way kids, his kids, watch television. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest is comic Jackie Mason. He made a major comeback last year when his one-man show, The World According to Me, became one of the hottest tickets on Broadway. The show is currently in hiatus while Mason is in Los Angeles, starring in the film Caddyshack 2. The World According to Me has generated more attention than anything Mason has done since the early 60s, when he made frequent appearances on The Ed Sullivan Show. The World According to Me has won a Tony, it's been published in book form, there's a recording of the show which has been nominated for a Grammy, and there's an HBO special which will have its final airing on February 29th. Jackie Mason comes from a long line of rabbis, and to fulfill his father's wishes, he entered the rabbinate as a young man. The nightclubs where he later established himself as a comic took him far away from the synagogue, but on the other hand, a lot of his material is still about being Jewish. He does a lot of self-deprecating Jewish humor, and he also gets in Gentile, Polish, Black, Puerto Rican, and wife jokes. I spoke with Jackie Mason when his show was still on Broadway. Here's an excerpt of his monologue on the differences between Jews and Gentiles.
A Jew's whole life is absolutely different than a Gentile's. It's fascinating to notice that a Jew can't even fix a car. Did you ever notice that? He cannot fix anything. A Gentile car breaks down in 2 seconds. They're under the car, on top of the car. They clap, they hack, it becomes an airplane. There he goes. A Jewish car breaks down, you always hear the same thing. It stopped. And the wife always says, it's your fault. And he says, I know what it is, it's in the hood. Where's the hood? I don't remember there was a hood. Takes a Jew 3 hours to open a hood, then he looks under the hood. Hey, is it busy here? Then he makes a move and she hollers, watch out, you'll hurt yourself. I'm not making it up. Go into any Gentile home. Any Gentile home is a workshop. Why is that? The whole house is a workshop. Every place you go in a Gentile home, they clop, they hack. They take you right to the basement and they clop, and they hack, and they're fixing and banging and clanging. A Jewish house is a museum. The whole house is a museum. The Gentiles are clapping and the Jews are clapping. Every Gentile, as soon as you say hello, he's fixing and building. The whole house was rebuilt and refixed. The toilet was once a chair. The living room was once a ping pong table. The bedroom was once a kitchen. This was something else. The furnace was once a toilet. This was something. The whole lobby was in the loft. This was something else. The wall was in the this was in Pittsburgh. Everything was someplace else. Go into a Jewish house, nothing was ever fixed, everything was imported, exported. In a Jewish house, everything is coming and going, it's a whole shipping department, the whole house. No matter what you see, this is nothing, wait till you see what I'm getting.
Jackie Mason, you come from an Orthodox family of rabbis. Were you exposed to comics or to nightclubs when you were growing up?
Not only wasn't I exposed to comics, I never even heard of comics. I didn't know there was such a thing as comedians when I was growing up. I thought when I was funny around the table in the house, I thought I was the only person who knew how to be funny in this whole world. I never saw comedians because you're always in the yeshiva, which is a Hebrew academy to study to become a rabbi. And the only thing I saw was rabbis in front of me, teaching me to keep my mouth shut, not to talk, not to say something funny, not to talk aloud, not to talk at all, not to move, not to turn, just to sit and pass away right in front of people. That's all you're taught. It's a very rigid kind of an atmosphere, and certainly nightclubs was the most distant thing from my life. It's as far as It's like mining for uranium. You didn't see it in the neighborhood.
Do you remember?
You know uranium exists, but you don't expect to bump into it.
Do you remember the first time you went to a nightclub and saw a comic?
As a matter of fact, the first time I was ever in a nightclub where a comic was performing, it was me.
You're kidding.
I never was in the inside of a nightclub. I knew of a nightclub from movies by that time. Because I saw a few pictures, Humphrey Bogart would go into a nightclub, so I knew what it meant. But I was never actually personally inside of a nightclub until I myself played a nightclub. What happened was that I was in the mountains in the Catskills, and I was telling jokes, and I was a big hit among the Jewish people in a small hotel. And the next thing I knew, somebody wanted to take a chance with me in a nightclub. And that was my first appearance at a nightclub, and it's the first time I was ever in there.
So you kind of had to make it up as you went along, as far as what your act was going to be like. You had nobody to pattern it on.
I had nobody to pattern it on at the beginning, except what I thought sounded funny to me that made people laugh. And I found that making people laugh came very natural and easy to me.
It's funny. You've said that you became a rabbi because you didn't want to disobey your father, and your father wanted you to become a rabbi. And it's ironic to think of someone like you who's built their career on irreverence to be afraid of going against their father.
Well, the truth of the matter is, it was very difficult for me psychologically to give up the religion and the rabbinate and everything that religion represented, because I knew that my father lived for nothing but this. It was a history going back a million years. It's like the King of England when he got off the throne. Everybody else says, so what if you're not a king? There's a lot of people who are not kings. Thank God you're not, so go for a walk, keep yourself busy. But to him, not to be a king was a difficult problem. Because he was born to be a king. In the same sense, I was born to be a rabbi. I was born to be a rabbi more than he was to be a king. That guy had no troubles compared to me. He only had countries involved. I had a mother and a father sitting in front of me, getting nauseous every 5 minutes, passing away from the misery.
Did you learn anything about timing and working an audience when you were delivering sermons as a rabbi?
As a matter of fact, that's a good question. You know, it's hard to believe that you're going to get a good question on a show like this. But this is a very good question. I'm kidding. I hope you noticed that. I noticed you're not laughing when I said that.
I didn't know how to take it.
Because this is a very incisive question. Very few people think of asking a question that has that much insight. I'm proud of that question. I'm so proud of the question, I forgot the answer. Anyway, the point is that there is a very great similarity between a rabbi delivering sermons and a comedian telling jokes. Because if a rabbi is strictly serious on the pulpit, he'll lose his whole audience in an hour, because people don't really go to a congregation or a religious house of worship to practice religion. They go there to practice everything but religion. It's a community center of activity. It's the only place where the Jewish people get together, and they're there for different reasons than religion. Ostensibly, the pretense, it's a religious house of worship, but everybody's there for everything but that. They're comparing coats, they're comparing jackets, they're comparing bank books, who has a bigger diamond than who had a baby, who could have had a baby, who had a baby that was married, that never got married, that forgot to get married. It's a place where they gossip about each other's lives, because it's the only place they get together. It's like Gentiles have a bar, Jews have a temple.
So,
and the Jewish temple becomes the place where you gossip about everything. And when the rabbi, when he starts preaching to you about religion, he's only an intrusion. He's a disturbance to them. All of a sudden, you have to keep quiet, and you can't pass all the gossip around.
Is this a place where you could let your sense of humor come
out?
So
if the rabbi was missing or passed away, they'd be much happier. However, if he's a capable rabbi, he has to try to find a way to mesh that need of the people for gossip and entertainment, and also at the same time slip some significance into his messages, because he's morally obligated to do it, to teach them and preach to them about something moral, meaningful, about the life of the hereafter, about more profound thoughts and ideas of why we're here on this earth. But if he just stays that serious, philosophical and religious, he'll lose the whole congregation in an hour and a half. He'll be talking to himself, and everybody will be sleeping in the place. It'll please become a bedroom instead of a congregation if he gets that serious. So he has to try to be entertaining, and the most effective rabbis always try to bring it down to the common denominator and try to talk about things that interest them in terms and in ways that'll entertain them at the same time that he delivers his point.
So you told some jokes?
Right. And the jokes got better and better. Then I started to charge a cover and a minimum. That's a joke for my act.
Right, right. And my guest is Jackie Mason, who has a very big hit called The World According to Me. And there's also a book called The World According to Me that features some of his material from that show, and it's just been published by Simon & Schuster. You got your start as a comic in the Borscht Belt, in the Jewish resort hotels of the Catskill Mountains in New York. The Borscht Belt always had comic headliners, and
right.
I wonder why you think that there are so many Jewish comics and why Jewish audiences really love comics so much.
That's also a very good question. I'm really surprised you're this intelligent a person. I never heard this about you. Listen to this. I almost heard you laugh again. It's not easy. Listen, the reason that Jews are so fascinated with comedy, in my opinion, is because Jews were always felt like a beleaguered minority, always felt like they were being persecuted, and as a matter of fact, always were being persecuted. And when you can't fight back and there's no way out of your misery and the problems that you're suffering from, you try to make life more bearable by telling some jokes to each other, by trying to be funny, by trying to find humor in the situation. People need an escape. Let's be honest about it. There's a lot of studies have been made about the times when the movies are most popular, and they found movies are most popular in the Depression periods, when people need escape the most. Now, ostensibly, people go for entertainment when they have more money and when times are better. That's what people thought. But when they made a study of it, they found exactly the opposite is true, that people go to the movies more when times are worst.
You told us that you had really never seen comics and hadn't been in nightclubs until you started performing yourself. Once you started performing, I'm sure you started seeing other Jewish comics like Myron Cohn, who was considerably older than you. How did you think you compared to the older generation of Jewish comics who had a lot of Yiddish material in their act?
I'll be honest with you. It's a misnomer to imagine that I have Jewish material in my act, because I don't. I sound so Jewish that people think I'm talking Jewish. Then they imagine I'm talking about Jewish subjects. The fact of the matter is I'm talking about nothing that has anything to do with Jewishness. It's just that I'm so Jewish, you got mesmerized into thinking I'm telling you Jewish jokes.
But you use Yiddish in your material.
I definitely don't.
Oh, wait. How about Miklutzmir? Did I say that right?
That's a meaningless little expression that I might use, mechakt, meklapt. It's a meaningless word that I just use as an expression. And you find maybe two Jewish expressions in 2 hours of my performance. None of my jokes are in Jewish, and none of my subject matter is particularly Jewish. I talk about life in general. Sometimes I talk about how Jews behave compared to Gentiles, or there's a lot of ethnic comedy in my jokes. But the ethnic comedy is about the difference in people's behavior patterns in accordance to their ethnic backgrounds, which is basically a sociological study. It's not in any way a Jewish approach to comedy. I don't tell jokes about Jews like in the same sense that Myron Cohen does, with depicting the typical Jewish character and using a Jewish accent to express a Jewish personality. I just happen to talk with an accent.
One of the very funny things you say in your show is that you're comparing Gentile and Jewish audience reactions to your show, and you say that the Gentiles see the show and they say, it's a hit, and the Jews see the show and they say, it's too Jewish.
Right.
Is this a typical reaction that you get?
It's I don't know if it's typical, but it's certainly pretty common, because the Jews, as I say in my act, are very self-conscious about being Jewish. I say they suffer from a terrible conflict constantly. They like to tell you how proud they are to be Jewish, but if a person is so proud, why would he cut off his name and his nose? Jews cut off their names and noses more than any other denomination in the world, at the same time that they tell you with such pride about how Jewish they are. If you're so proud, I don't notice Italians cutting off their names. If he's Italian and his name is Mangiapane, he doesn't call himself Mange, he's Mangiapane. You don't hear a Polish person whose name is Askarachowicz all of a sudden call him Ashkapa. He's Ashkapachowicz, whatever his name is. But as soon as a Jew is named Goldberg, he becomes Gold, then he becomes Good, then he becomes Heheh. He doesn't want to have too much of a name that should sound Jewish. Jewish women are notoriously embarrassed and disturbed. They even get nauseous if you tell them they look Jewish. You tell a Gentile girl she looks Jewish, she thinks, well, that sounds continental. You tell it to a Jewish girl, I look Jewish, she wants to pass away in a second.
My guest is Jackie Mason.
That's right.
Let's talk about 1964, when you did the now famous Ed Sullivan show, and you were in the middle of your routine. He was gesturing you to get off because he had just gotten word that the president was going to make a short speech, and it was going to interrupt the program. So he was gesturing you to get off, and you were gesturing him with the same kind of fingers he was giving you. He later said that you gave him the finger. You denied it. There was almost a suit and a countersuit. But anyways, what went through your mind when he was giving you the signals to get off?
Boy, you do a lot of homework. You'd have
I watched the show, didn't you?
Oh, you watched the show at that
all
time?
All of America was watching the Ed Sullivan Show then,
oh,
right?
Oh, boy. You know everything. You're like an encyclopedia of my career.
But the you're truth not enjoying this interview very much, are you?
No, I love it. I love it. I'm getting a kick out of the fact that you paid that much attention. I certainly love it. That's a great compliment that somebody knows that much about you. Anyway, the point is that what happened there, as you just recounted it, is exactly right. That's exactly what did happen. You sound like you just read about it last night, because the fact is that he misunderstood my gesture, because he himself thought that when a guy moves a finger, the only thing he himself could think of was a dirty gesture. Because he came from the New York streets, and he knew about dirty gestures. I came from rabbinical institutions all my life, and I never heard of a dirty gesture when I came to his show. I had no idea what it even meant. Now, the proof of the matter is that I was right. I was telling this to people for 20 years, and they were very cynical when I would say it this way, because they would say, who is he kidding? He didn't know what it meant. He's a phony, because Ed Sullivan called me a fraud and a liar, and he said that I purposely gave him a filthy gesture. So naturally, if he's the superstar and the symbol of authority in America, and I'm a young budding comedian who doesn't mean that much, they have to assume that I'm the liar and he's telling the truth. And then they even imagined they saw what he told them they saw, a filthy gesture. But just 2 months ago, on 2020, Barbara Walters replayed that actual scene from the old tape. And when they replayed the tape, they actually went in slow motion following my gesture. I don't know if you saw that particular show.
I actually saw that too, yeah.
And they proved on television that I never made such a gesture. Barbara Walters said to America, isn't it amazing how a person could be so misunderstood?
You know what amazes me?
Yes.
How you could have performed for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years and still not known what the finger was?
Because I was never performing among... I didn't even know, to this day, I don't even know what the pot looks like or what is that thing, Coke. I wouldn't know Coke if I saw it, if I fell over it. I never mingled with people who talk this way or behave this way, and I still don't. And I was never involved in the street corner type of conversation. To this day, I don't tell dirty jokes. I don't use one off-color word, and I never have. That's just not my character or my nature. Now, people who live like that, maybe people like you who know from these things, can't find it hard for you to believe that I don't, because I happen to live a much cleaner life than you.
Right, well, I guess when the interview's over, I should inform you about the things you've been missing out on, right? So after this...
I really don't know from these things. It's not the way I live.
So after this happened on the Ed Sullivan Show, did you feel like you were being blacklisted?
I was not being blacklisted, but it really put a bad damper in my career. I can't deny that, because I was a very hot piece of property at that time. I seemed to be zooming with a brilliant new career. I was a conversation piece as the new hot comic, or one of the 2-3 hottest comics in the country. I was not yet a major star, but it looked like I was being offered every major situation that I would inevitably become a major star in a very short order. And all of a sudden, that put a definite crimp in it. All of a sudden, people saw me as some kind of a crazy maniac who can't be trusted. When Ed Sullivan said that this man did a filthy thing, people who watched the show actually thought they saw it, and they never did. But that's amazing power of suggestion. If the chief rabbi of Israel tells all the Jews they're passing away on Thursday, they'll start to think they are.
My guest is Jackie Mason, and his one-man show is called The World According to Me. The World According to Me is also the title of his new book, which features a lot of the material that he's doing in the show.
It's not only a big hit, it's a phenomenal... unbelievable kind of a happening. People all over the world are coming from China, from Africa. They're coming without clothes because they don't even get a chance to get dressed. They're in such a hurry to get there.
Well, we'll have more adjectives about this show after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Comedian Jackie Mason is my guest. Since you've been back in New York, have you gone back to your old neighborhood in the Lower East Side of Manhattan?
I have been in the neighborhood a couple of times and just rode around a little to look at it. It's a totally different kind of a neighborhood now. It was the whole world changed there. It used to be mostly very poor, poverty-stricken Jews. Now it's mostly Puerto Rican and Spanish and some black people, and they seem to be doing better than the Jews did at that time. Because, thank God, now there's more opportunities to get some help from the government. At that time, there was almost nothing, 30, 40 years ago.
Your brothers are still rabbis, even though you left the rabbinate. They're still rabbis. Do you ever go to their services?
Yes, I was just there for the high holidays.
So do you have to stand up and take a bow in the middle of the service?
Well, I can't deny that they get pretty excited about me showing up. It's like the boy coming back home, and it's a fabulous feeling to see how much pleasure they get out of my becoming such a hit. Becoming a hit is a stunning feeling. You always read constantly about some people who can't handle success and how they suffer with success and how it makes them miserable and how some people want to commit suicide who are so successful, how it has an adverse opposite kind of effect on some people. I don't know why and how it could be possible unless the person is terrifically sick and that person should immediately go for help. It's like if I give you $3 million and you can't enjoy it, and the only thing you could say is that it's making you suffer, then you better run to a doctor immediately. That's a lot worse than a bad case of tonsils.
You started out without any experience having seen comics. Did comics take you under their wing and bring you into the club, so to speak?
I'll tell you frankly, I'm not too close to too many comedians. I find that there's too much jealousy among comedians. This is a very, very insecure, nerve-wracking business. Everybody's on an ego trip that's usually sick to one extent or another. Most people don't become comedians because they want to entertain people. They become comedians because they feel rejected and nervous and helpless. All the studies made about comedians and their personality structure shows that they're all psycho cases. That it's very hard to find a normal comedian. A person who's so desperate for attention that he has to become a comedian, it has to be sick to start with. It has to be a chemical or emotional imbalance. You have to feel terribly rejected in your house, in your home, in your environment. There was a big brother who was 10 times smarter. There was a sister who was 10 times prettier. You were the one neglected, rejected. You were really short, fat, or ugly, or miserable, nauseous, and disturbed. And you got absolutely nothing to live for. As a desperate move, you take a chance and you become a comedian. That's how most comedians start. And all the studies made of their character, their personalities, proves that they almost always start from a warped position of a sick personality. And then the answer to a terrible personality problem and a terrible feeling of total rejection is to either hide completely or to go in exactly the opposite direction. It's like the old story. From one family, you either become a murderer or a judge. One brother becomes a murderer, the next one a judge from the same family. And people say, why? It's because both people needed something extreme to overcome the misery of their circumstances. A comedian is in a very extreme way of looking for attention. You know how sick you have to be to go up on a stage in Iowa to people that never heard of you, and you're 19 or 22 years old, and you have to beg people to laugh at you with jokes that are not finished yet, and feel all the rejection and the contempt that people have for a person who's wasting their time not being funny. If you sing a song and it stinks, nobody notices it because they heard of the song, it's close enough, it's better than nothing. But if you hear a joke you never heard before and it stinks, you're wasting the guy's time and the guy is getting nauseous and he wants to throw a chair at you.
Is this a way of saying that you've been a psycho case yourself and that's
right.
Why you're a comedian?
That's right. I can't deny it. I certainly am. I always felt rejected in my environment at home. I had three brothers older than me. I always felt left out. The brother right above me was a phenomenal genius. He's an absolute genius. By the time he was 9, he was graduating from 4 universities. He was getting medals of honor from people who had never heard of him. He was sitting around with all kinds of medals like a general. And I was the one who nobody noticed. So I started to try to be funny. It's not hard to tell what motivated me to try to look for attention in one way or another and to overcompensate by being the belle of the ball by becoming a comedian, because I knew I couldn't compete with him scholastically or intellectually.
Do you think you put on a stronger Yiddish accent for your act than you do when you're talking?
I have no awareness at all about my accent. As a matter of fact, I never even knew I had an accent. I always concentrated on the substance of the significance of the meaning of the message, of the point that I'm trying to make, of the way to construct the joke, to make it as funny as possible. But it was all in the construction of the words and the thoughts and the ideas behind it. It never was involving any kind of a style of performance. Of a style of delivery. I never concentrated on how to deliver a joke in terms of my words or my moves or my gestures. I never thought of that. The performance element was never involved in my mind at all, and it's still not.
You seem to me to be one of the comics who's never had any writers write for them. Is that right?
Right. I never did.
Why?
Because I don't need them. Why don't I have somebody sit down for me? Because I sit down myself. Why don't I go for somebody to dance for me? I dance myself. If this is my business, I don't feel like I need somebody else to do it for me. Not that I'm reflecting against the ones who do. There's nothing wrong with doing words that somebody else wrote. If you could do them effectively and get the same laugh, who says that you have to write it yourself? Nobody does. People play Shakespeare. They don't have to be Shakespeare. But I don't find that I need somebody else to write for me. I like what I come up with, and I am involved in my own thoughts, and it expresses my own ideas. And one of the pleasures in my mind, as much as performing it, is the thought of it. And I'd like to be the one who thought of it.
You make all these comparisons in your routines between Jews and Gentiles. Let's see which of them hold up for you. That Jews aren't handy around the house, don't know how to fix cars, anything like that. What about you?
The fact of the matter is that most of these jokes happen to be a reflection of me. I really can't fix a car, and I don't have one friend that I know that could. So I find it very typical. You see, none of these generalities obviously pertain to everyone. If you meet 300 Jews, you'll usually find one that could actually fix a car. But if you meet 300 Gentiles, you'll meet 280 that could fix a car.
Okay, let's try another one. When your show is over, you can tell the difference between a Jew and a Gentile because the Gentile will say, let's go have a drink, and the Jew will say, have you eaten yet?
Now, that is the very biggest laugh in my whole act, because obviously it must be more true than anything else. You could tell by the size of a laugh how true something is. Unless there's instant fantastic identification with the truth of a line, you'll never get a major reaction from it, because they won't know exactly what the point is, or they won't feel the point. When they feel it in their guts is when you know you're a real hit. As soon as I say Gentiles never finish drinking and Jews never finish eating, every Gentile leaving this building is going to say the same thing, have a drink. Everybody breaks up, and since there's more Jews in the audience usually than Gentiles, it's about 60-70% Jewish. As soon as I say that, and the Jews all say the same thing too, did you eat yet? Every Jew falls off the floor, because it's exactly true. They know how exactly true it is. Jews are always talking about food. If you meet a Gentile, the first thing he says to you, where can we go for a drink? You meet a Jew, they always say, where can we go for coffee? But they won't go there for coffee unless they know they have good cake in that place. Because a Gentile refers to coffee as coffee. When a Jew talks about coffee, he's thinking about cake.
So what about you? Do you eat more than you drink?
I never drink at all. I don't drink liquor.
Really?
No.
So, but are you really preoccupied with food?
I don't know if I'm preoccupied, but I know that it's a great part of my life in terms of my conversation and my choices of restaurants. Why do you think Jews inhabit restaurants a lot more than Gentiles do, percentage-wise? Everybody who owns a restaurant will tell you that if he's in a Jewish neighborhood, he's a hit in 5 minutes, because as soon as a Jew sees a restaurant, he goes there to try it out. And he doesn't care what kind of food it is. The Jews are always eating foods they never heard of. A Gentile eats his own type of food. If he wants a steak, he wants a roast beef. A Jew is always looking for Australian food. They're looking for food they never heard of. Did you hear about this new New Zealand dish? Did you hear? They're not talking about a girl. They're talking about food. They're always thinking of dishes they never heard of, exotic dishes, an Albanian cheese. They're looking for something that they always find a new item.
Well, Jackie Mason, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure. You're a lovely lady. I haven't seen you yet, but I love your attitude and your intelligence of your questioning.
Jackie Mason spoke to us from the NPR Bureau in New York. His one-man show, The World According to Me, will reopen in New York on May 3rd. The record of the show has been nominated for a Grammy, and Mason will appear at the Grammy ceremonies on March 2nd. And the HBO special of The World According to Me will be aired on Monday, February 29th. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Divine, the actor who starred in both male and female roles in John Waters movies. Divine stars in the new John Waters film, Hairspray. I hope you can join us.
Jews are the only people who say that I'm too Jewish. Isn't that ironic? If a Gentile doesn't like me, could live without me. But Jews constantly say, too Jewish. Every single day, I meet a Yente one after the other that comes over to me. You don't have to talk like that. Why do you talk like that? Can't you talk like me? Talk like a regular person. Now, to a Jew, nobody is too Spanish, nobody is too Italian, nobody is too French, but you're too Jewish. Why does it bother a Jew that somebody sounds Jewish? Because they somehow think that if it's Jewish, it's got no class. No class if it's Jewish. Why do you think in Miami Beach, everybody is named Goldberg or Horowitz?
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by a major grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and a grant from Fisher's World Travel Guides. Fisher's World Guidebooks featuring the removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, what a long, strange trip it's been. A talk with Grateful Dead lyricist Robert Hunter. He sings his own songs on his new album, Liberty. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the home video release of Repercussions, the British documentary on African and Afro-American music that features jazz drummer Max Roach and profiles Ghana's high life music. And television critic David Bianculli says his kids don't watch TV the way he did, and the VCR has a lot to do with it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Lori Waffen-Schmidt. The White House said today that nothing has changed following the release of a videotape made by the captors of Marine Lieutenant Colonel William Higgins. On the tape, Higgins repeats the demands of his captors for his release. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Organization of the Oppressed on Earth, which claimed responsibility for Higgins' kidnapping last week, sent the tape to a Western news agency in Beirut. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said the tape, which shows Higgins reading a statement, was, quote, obviously made under duress. Among other things, the statement called for the release of Israeli forces from southern Lebanon and the release of Arab prisoners held by the Israelis. State Department spokeswoman Phyllis Oakley said today the Reagan administration continues to try to get Higgins free.
We don't have any specific comments on the demands. We continue our efforts to secure the safe release of Lieutenant Colonel Higgins. Terrorists will not determine our policies.
And, added White House spokesman Fitzwater, we don't make deals with terrorists, period. I'm Brian Naylor at the White House.
A memo that's the focal point of a criminal investigation of Attorney General Edwin Meese was released today. The memo says a portion of $65 to $70 million in payments were to go to the Israeli Labor Party for its support of a pipeline deal with Iraq. Such payments are illegal in the U.S. The memo was addressed to Meese by his longtime friend E. Robert Wallach. Meese says he doesn't recall reading the portion of the memo relating to the payments to the Israelis. The memo was released by Meese's attorneys, who say it shows that Meese couldn't possibly have understood that there was a bribe or payoff included in the plan. The Secretary of the Navy quit his job today in protest over budget cuts, and he accused the Secretary of Defense of ignoring the advice of the top military brass. NPR's David Malpas reports.
James Webb had been Navy Secretary for less than a year. A Marine veteran and feisty Pentagon official, he came on board at a time when the Reagan administration was being forced to cut its military spending plans. In the latest round of cuts, Defense Secretary Frank Carlucci decided to abandon the long-held goal of a 600-ship Navy. Instead, the Navy would have to settle for 580 ships. Today, Webb said that was unwise and unnecessary. He proposed other cuts to meet the budget, but Secretary Carlucci rejected them. In his resignation letter, Webb said he could not support Carlucci personally or defend the budget. He accused Carlucci of providing a lack of leadership in protecting the defense budget. A Pentagon official said, under the circumstances, Webb did the honorable thing by quitting. Carlucci did not respond to the criticism today, but the White House defended the Secretary of Defense and expressed regret that the Navy Secretary found it necessary to leave. Webb, a successful novelist, says he'll return to writing. I'm David Malpas in Washington.
Israeli soldiers shouldn't use beatings as a means of punishing or humiliating Palestinians. That order today from Israel's Attorney General Yosef Harish. The Attorney General told the Defense Ministry to issue clearly written instructions to troops that force is only to be used when subduing a prisoner or breaking up a demonstration, and then only the minimum necessary to do the job. There was no immediate comment from Defense Minister Yitzhak Rabin. About a month ago, Rabin announced that soldiers would beat Palestinians instead of shooting at them to quell disturbances. The White House says President Reagan will hold a news conference on Wednesday night, his first formal meeting with reporters in 4 months. It will take place a week before the president is due to travel to Brussels for a NATO summit meeting. The falling dollar last year brought more foreign tourists to the U.S. than ever before. A record 29 billion visitors spent some $19.5 billion during their visits. The Japanese tourists spent more than any other group. The government projects even more foreign tourists this year. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed at 2040.29, gaining more than 25 points. You're listening to National Public Radio in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review of a music documentary series now available in America on 4 home video cassettes. Repercussions is a 7-hour series on African and Afro-American music, first aired on Britain's Channel 4 in 1984. One of the cassettes pairs a survey of the Los Angeles rhythm and blues scene with a documentary on drummer Max Roach that features a performance by his percussion ensemble, M. Boom.
Seven documentaries in the Repercussions series stand up on their own, but taken together form a complex epic of cultural diaspora and return. Three of these hours were shot in the U.S., three in West Africa, and one in the Caribbean. Their underlying thesis is that African musical traditions, introduced into new environments, continually reinvent themselves. In the first installment, Gambian musicians play traditional string and percussion music, faintly but recognizably related to jazz and blues. In the final program, high-life musicians from Ghana incorporate major scales, electric guitars, and portable keyboards into their music. These episodes are presented with minimal narration. The filmmakers trust you to draw your own connections. Images and musical motifs may repeat from show to show, setting up patterns of theme and variation. From a jazz critic's perspective, most interesting is a portrait of the American drummer Max Roach called Sit Down and Listen, which contains a healthy sampling of his varied music. He plays solos on hi-hat and the full drum kit and appears with his 9-piece percussion ensemble, M. Boom. He plays a concert with his jazz quartet and jazz quartet plus string quartet. Roach is a great small group conceptualist as well as a great drummer. He's one of the rare jazz musicians to do something constructive with strings. On trumpeter Cecil Bridgewater's Birds Says, the Swedenborg string quartet is used like a horn, one voice threading through the ensemble. Max Roach is a courageous musician whose art has never stopped growing and an articulate champion of Afro-American culture, all of which comes across clearly in this documentary. There is a side to Roach it doesn't show. To an extent, he's plagued by the same insecurities that plague us all, and experience has taught him to be guarded. But director Jeffrey Hayden catches the private Max Roach as well as the public one. We see him attending a memorial service for his mother in rural North Carolina, where he was born. Visiting his old neighborhood in Brooklyn, where as a teen he'd punished the drums until the neighbors begged for mercy, singing at the piano in his Manhattan home overlooking Central Park. He also tells a good story at his own expense, like this one about how Charlie Parker deflated his drummer's big head back in the 40s.
I'm exclusive now. The drummer on 52nd Street, Kenny Clarke, is in Europe, and Shadow Wilson's in, you know, so
I got, my head was opening up, big head, so I'd come to the rehearsals a little late. And I remember coming to one rehearsal, the Three Deuces, and Charlie Parker was sitting on the drums, and this is the first time I was introduced to what drummers now call separation. And he had a name for everybody. Since we were in the war and I wore these thick horn rim glasses, I was Tojo. And he was sitting behind my drums, and he said, Tojo, can you do this? And he did a quarter note on the bass drum, a Charleston beat on the sax cymbal, a shuffle rhythm on the left hand, and the rhythm, the jazz beat, chick-cha-chang, chick-cha-chang, with the right hand, all at the same time, comfortably, with a saxophone across his lap. It's impossible to do unless you practice it. So I walked up to he got up and I walked over to the stage and I attempted to do it and I knew I had to practice it and it put and now he put me back to where I should be, have been all the time.
The Repercussion series portrays black musicians not as romantic outsiders, but rather as well-adjusted and well-regarded social beings. In one show, the drum and vocal ensemble in a West African village seems to be a fraternal lodge, town historian, brass band, and Greek chorus all in one. On the same two-hour tape as the Max Roach documentary is a program about the Los Angeles rhythm and blues scene, where a flute-playing religious letter carrier who lives over at the Garden Apartments turns out to be saxophone shouter Big J. McNeely. His honking and screaming marathons were among the series' dramatic high points. Britain's Repercussion series is, if nothing else, a reminder of how poorly American television, private or public, has dealt with the riches of Afro-American music. If you want to see it in the U.S., you'll have to shell out the bucks for the video cassettes. As far as I can determine, Repercussions has never been shown on domestic TV. It deserves a wider audience.
Kevin Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the Repercussion series distributed on video cassette by Home Vision. We're listening to Big J. McNeely. This is Fresh Air. Jerry Garcia and Robert Hunter met when they were teenagers. Ever since Jerry Garcia formed the Grateful Dead in the mid-60s, Robert Hunter has written most of the lyrics for Garcia's songs, lyrics most Dead fans know by heart.
Well, the first days are the hardest days, don't you worry anymore. 'Cause when life looks like easy street, there is danger at your door. Think this through with me. Let me know your mind. What I want to know is, are you kind? Truckin', got my chips cashed in. Keep truckin', like the doodah man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep truckin', on, on.
Shoes on the hand, it fits.
Robert Hunter doesn't perform his songs with the Grateful Dead, but occasionally he steps in front of the microphone to record an album of his own songs. He has a new album called Liberty, for which he wrote both words and music. Jerry Garcia is featured on lead guitar. Robert Hunter sings.
A bird with a tear in his eye, walking to New Orleans, my, my, my. Hey, now, bird, wouldn't you rather die than walk this world when you're born to fly? If I was a son, I'd...
Do you write different kinds of songs for yourself than you do for the Grateful Dead?
I tend to, when I know that I'm writing for the Grateful Dead, I understand that there's a lot of people out there who are going to be listening to it. And I tend to speak in a more general way. When I'm writing for myself, then I can make song more personal. I don't, it only needs to reflect my point of view as opposed to the more Catholic, universal tastes of Grateful Dead appealing to masses.
When you're writing a song with Garcia and he's writing the music, you're writing the lyrics, let me ask that age-old question of which comes first.
Well, what's happening right now is Jerry's coming over to the house every day. We're getting some songs together for a new album, and I give him some starter ideas, and he looks at those, and we just batter it back and forth and back and forth. The songs for Grateful Dead are true collaboration for the most part. There are times when I've handed him lyrics and he's set them, other times when he's handed me accomplished changes and I've put words to those. But when it works best is when we actually get our heads together and battle it back and forth until there's something that we mutually agree on.
The Dead have a huge tribal following. Do those people know about your own records, and do you think that a lot of them buy your records?
There's an element that buys my records. It tends to be more of the intellectual part of the Deadhead scene. You know, I don't generally put out a lot of dance type music. Tend to a more serious introspective music. But on the Liberty album, I'm making a little bit of a try to make something that'll hit on both levels.
When you were traveling with the band, and the people who were on stage would get so much attention, would you ever feel a little left out as the lyricist who wasn't on the stage, basking in all the glory?
Oh, you bet I did. Oh, it was misery. All those jerks up there getting all that glory and all the girls and everything like that, and just miserable. All I had was my spiral notebook. Yeah, boy. Well, I'll get even.
Can you confirm this for me? I read somewhere that you were one of the participants in the Stanford University program of government experimentation with LSD in the early 1960s?
Yeah, they paid me $140 to take first LSD, second psilocybin, I think third mescaline, and then the fourth week all three of them together.
No kidding.
which was a joy in one way, but they also came and took 5 cc's of blood every 2 hours, and when you're hoinged out on acid, here comes Dracula again.
Oh, gosh, what did they tell you about LSD before they gave it to you the first time?
Nothing. They didn't want me to know a thing about it, and I lied to them. I told them that I knew nothing about it, and I had read Doors of Perception, in fact.
Oh, and that's why you wanted to be in the program, probably.
Yeah. And they called it, the word at the time was psychotomimetic drugs, miming psychosis, and they wanted to find out if it increased your ability to be hypnotized and to take suggestions. And I don't know what they found out from that. I was sitting there, and they were trying to run these little hypnotic things on me, I remember, and all of a sudden tears began running out of my eyes, and the psychologist said, well, what's happening here? And I said, well, it's kind of hard to describe, but I'm out in the fifth dimension somewhere, and I'm a great jade green Buddha, and there's a pool growing out of my lap, and it's just, and the water of the pool is running out of my eyes. I'm not really crying. You know? I think they began twigging that they were onto something a little bit more than a simple heightening of suggestibility here.
Do you think that tripping a lot changed the kind of lyrics that you were writing?
Oh, it had to.
Yeah.
It had to. I mean, I was tripping around in mystic space and making the mystic connections, which I think were right for the time. I look back on that stuff with a great deal of affection. I know where it comes from, and I think people do. It was part and parcel of that generation. Don't write like that anymore, but I don't take the drug anymore.
I figure if I had a nickel for everyone who got really high and listened to your lyrics and tried to figure out the more elliptical imagery, that I'd really be a wealthy woman. What are some of the crazier interpretations you've gotten of some of your song lyrics?
Oh, heavens. Well, there was a time, it may still be so, when people would swear that I was writing about them. And if something is personal enough, there's a certain line where it becomes universal. It's, you never know which ones will and which ones won't. I've written things which are so personal nobody could ever have the slightest idea, like, you know, look for a while at the China cat, sunflower proud, walking jingle in the midnight sun. Now, that gets into kind of Joycean word salad, and some people, strangely enough, know just what I mean by it, but I couldn't explain that.
Can I ask you about a song? You know the song Uncle John's Band?
Mm-hmm.
One of the lines is, when life looks like easy street, there's danger at your door.
Oh, God, is that true?
Can I ask if you were you thinking of something specific when you wrote that?
I was thinking about the sort of the hippie self-congratulatory thing that we've really conquered all this. You know, here we've entered the Vietnam War, we've done this, the other thing, and things looking rosy. No, it's liberty. The price is eternal vigilance.
With your new album, Liberty, out, I'm wondering if you're at all shy about performing.
I'm thinking about it. Now, I haven't been out. I did a national tour last year for a month, but I just go out by myself or with my wife. I don't have any entourage. We book ourselves and we get ourselves from place to place, and it's the way I choose to do things. And it's hard. It's very hard. I think I will go out again, but I am aware that I'm robbing from my writing time when I do this, and I think I'm more valuable to people as a writer than I am as a performer, a stage performer.
Robert Hunter, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Well, you're welcome, Terry.
Robert Hunter's new album, Liberty, is on Relics Records. He's also done a new translation of the Duino Elegies by Rainer Maria Rilke, published by Hulagosi Books in Eugene, Oregon. Hunter spoke to us from station KQED in San Francisco.
You say I'm a lying man, a little but to see. Say so to the jury friend, and thus they do believe. I was born one reckless form 10,000 years ago. Jay Sean Doolittle sworn.
You're listening to Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up with full coverage of today's news. Let's check in with co-host Renee Montaigne and see what they have planned. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
What story is he following?
Well, tonight we have a report on a draft of a State Department report that concludes that Mexico and Panama are doing enough to fight drug trafficking, and members of Congress are calling that State Department conclusion outrageous. Also, a profile of Joe Clark. Joe Clark is the controversial New Jersey principal whose trademark accessories are a bullhorn and a baseball bat, and he uses them to keep kids in his school in line. And we also have, courtesy of Verdame Grosvenor, a profile of Langston Hughes. It includes a lot of poetry.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Wednesday night, The Wizard of Oz will be shown on TV for the 30th time. But since 50% of all American households now own VCRs, for many children this event is no big deal. Television critic David Bianculli says the way children bond with TV is different these days.
When I was a kid, The Wizard of Oz showed up on TV once a year, and kids across America waited for it like it was Christmas. We got to stay up late and watch Dorothy and Toto and the Wicked Witch of the West all over again, and we loved it. I have written proof of this, by the way. In 1960, when I was 7 years old, I wrote in my diary, "Today at 6 o'clock, I saw The Wizard of Oz." The Wizard of Oz was in big letters because it was a big deal. When my daughter was 2.5 years old, she saw The Wizard of Oz on TV, and she loved it. She didn't have to wait a year to see it again, though, because I taped it with my video cassette recorder. The minute it was over, she got up, pressed rewind, and watched it again. And when it got to one particular scene, she rewound and rewatched it over and over.
I'll get you, my pretty, and your little dog, too.
Now, even though I'm a TV critic, I don't think my kids are treating TV any differently than anybody else their age. Kristen is 5 now, and Mark is 3. But they're sure treating TV a lot differently than we did when we were kids. The way I see it, having them watch a particular tape over and over is no different than having them want to hear the same bedtime story every night. Kids are comforted by the familiar. And I figure the reason Kristen kept rewinding The Wicked Witch of the West was to keep watching until the witch didn't seem so wicked anymore. Another good thing about giving your kids a tape collection of their own is that you can control what they watch without being parental about it. I pre-screen every movie or show before I give them a copy, so everything is kind of pre-approved. When they want to watch TV, they almost always pick a tape. The only times they watch what they call live TV is to tune in the Disney Channel or Saturday morning cartoons. And that's one ritual from my own childhood that I'm glad my children have inherited. I used to get up early, pour some cereal in a bowl, and sit there watching the test patterns, waiting for the first round of cartoons to show up. My kids aren't quite that obsessed, but they do consider it a treat, and I'm not about to ruin it for them by explaining the concept of time shifting. That's where you set the timer on your VCR. Having a VCR is useful, though, if your kids start begging to stay up to watch just one more show. Just tell them you'll tape it and send them to bed. Technology triumphs. But not completely. It's taken away a little bit of the thrill. What good is it to wait for the annual Charlie Brown Christmas special on TV when you've already got it on tape? Is Pinocchio on cassette as powerful and wonderful as it was in the movie theater? No way. But it's a trade-off. My dad used to always moan about how tough he had it when he was a kid, and now I know how he feels. We had no VCRs and only black and white TV. When Dorothy landed in Oz, I didn't even know the Emerald City was really green.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post.
Please, please, sir. I've got to see the wizard. The Good Witch of the North sent me.
Prove it! She's wearing the ruby slippers she gave her. Oh, so she is! Well, bust my buttons! Why didn't you say that in the first place? That's a horse of a different color! Come on in!
Cabbie! Cabbie! Just what you're looking for. Take you any place in the city we does.
Would you take us to see the wizard?
The wizard? The wizard? My God.
Here's a look at the next fresh air. On our next show, I'll speak with writer Gloria Naylor. Her new novel, Mama Day, is about a conjure woman on a Georgia Sea island. Also, rock historian Ed Ward will profile the career of Doug Somm, the versatile Texas rock and roller who led the Sir Douglas Quintet. And just in time for spring training, our book critic John Leonard will review Season Ticket, Roger Angel's latest collection of baseball essays. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, WDUQ in Pittsburgh. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Gavin Morrison, Ruth Harold, Beth Wilcox, and Kathy Anderson. Our engineer is Audrey Voblaitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.